Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Got a great show for you today. Someone who's been a guest recently, but we're having him back again. Former Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Chris Hedges will be here to talk about his new book, Empire of Illusion. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This has been a summer of intense heat, violent storms, and AstroTurf. AstroTurf is D.C. slang for the phony grassroots organizations bought and paid for by various industry groups that have been sprouting up like mushrooms after the rain. AstroTurf spokesmen like Dick Armey of FreedomWorks and Tim Phillips of Americans for Prosperity rent themselves out to corporations, publishing op-eds, running ads, and showing up at events pretending to be angry citizens. Lately, they've been very active on a number of legislative fronts, spreading misinformation about the energy bill, health care reform, and financial regulation. Now the AstroTurf groups are turning their attention to net neutrality, the longstanding principle that keeps the open Internet free from corporate gatekeepers. Tim Carr of Free Press.
We're seeing AstroTurf groups attack net neutrality. Coincidentally, new legislation in favor of net neutrality, the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2009, was introduced in the beginning of August. So the AstroTurf has become very active, and we released an interactive online tool that exposes the fake grassroots at freepress.net/AstroTurf, where people can go and actually reveal the money behind these phony front groups.
There's a common theme across AstroTurf efforts this summer. Any new form of public policy or attempts to regulate industry in any way is called out as socialist or communist.
This sort of red baiting, you know, we haven't seen since the era of the Soviet Union and the Cold War. It seems to have reemerged in 2009 as the new face of AstroTurf.
How can this kind of fake public interest group be stopped? Carr says you have to expose them at every turn.
Call them out for presenting themselves as independent analysts on any given policy issue without fully disclosing the money that punches their tickets, which is a common practice. They very rarely, if ever, disclose that they're being funded by industry. And you also need to call out the media. It's just, you know, laziness on the part of the media. The media repeatedly refuses to cite the money behind these spokespeople.
Carr says that it's important whenever there's a spokesperson for one of these groups on a website or TV to provide feedback to the media.
I commonly go into the comment threads of stories on the Internet, and I point out to the journalist who reported the story and to the readers that that person is actually funded by industry.
For more information about AstroTurf, go to freepress.net/AstroTurf.
The month of August is typically quiet in Washington, D.C., but statistics have been pouring in that are making some noise. They illustrate the impact of government policy decisions on communities across America. This week, Media Minutes takes a look at a couple of examples. Speed is everything. Reports from the Communication Workers of America, Wired Magazine, PC World, and other companies have begun to shed light on the broadband industry's best-kept secret: that they can rarely deliver the speeds advertised. While fully verified testing has not been performed in the United States, others overseas have shown Americans have good cause for concern. According to a report released earlier this month by Ofcom, the United Kingdom's telecommunications regulatory agency, consumers were receiving broadband speeds that were 45% to 56% slower than advertised. And the Organization for Economic and Community Development reports there is a great disparity in many countries between the speeds advertised by internet service providers and the speeds actually available to the consumer. Cable prices continue to climb in Michigan. The Detroit Free Press reports that 3 years after Michigan passed major changes to its local cable TV regulations, which stripped franchising authority away from local municipalities and towns and gave it to the state, none of the promises of the bill have been delivered. Prices are still high and continue to rise. Entire communities have been left off the grid, and customer service has not improved. A survey funded by local governments found that basic cable TV rates rose from 9% to as much as 50% in 2008. And there has been essentially no increase in competition. Most communities have only one option available to them for cable TV service. And both Comcast and AT&T have poured substantial funds into campaign contributions for state politicians, surpassing even the donations of the Michigan-based Big Three auto companies.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact.
Despite high-speed internet making up 25% of a cable company's revenues, they devote no more than 3% of their cable lines to delivering broadband. That's according to Adam Lin, policy coordinator of Free Press. Meanwhile, Lin explains, it is estimated that a cable company's typical profit margin for broadband service is 80%.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings, I'm Bob McChesney. Welcome to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, who I announced at the top of the show, Chris Hedges, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter turned author, currently a resident at the Nation Institute, a senior fellow. He's written several books in the past, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and American Fascists. He's here to discuss his brand new book with us today, just released, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, recently published by Nation Books. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Media Matters.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, let's start right in on the book with the title, which is a fetching title, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. Why that title and what does it mean?
The purpose of the book was to describe all the ways we cut ourselves off from facing reality around us. There is a kind of ethic in American society that runs across the political spectrum, embraced by the Christian right, by corporatism, by Oprah, by self-help gurus, by Hollywood, that we as Americans can have everything we want. If we just dig deep enough within ourselves, if we find those inner resources and strengths, if we acknowledge that we are truly exceptional, reality will never be an impediment to our desires. And that's exceedingly dangerous, especially at a moment when that illusion is matched with a reality of horrific economic decline and the very destruction of the ecosystem that sustains the human species. It allows huge segments, I would probably argue the majority of Americans, to remain essentially removed from the reality that is happening around them. Now, as that chasm grows between the illusion of what they think is real or possible and what is actually happening, when it plays itself out in being foreclosed or in this very callous term that is being used by Larry Summers and others of a jobless recovery, when you sink into that kind of despair, what has happened is that you have not faced responsibly the world around you and essentially remained in a state of infantilism or childishness, and you react when the walls finally cave in, when that illusion implodes. Like a child, you search for saviors, demagogues, charlatans. And I think we're already beginning to glimpse this in the reaction to the very virulent reaction laced with the horrific language of violence and even displays of weaponry near presidential sites now as that gap widens. And so I tried to look at all of the ways within America, or many of the ways in American society we illusion ourselves, whether that's through celebrity culture, whether that's through positive psychology, whether that's through pornography. I mean, all of the various ways we delude ourselves into believing illusions are real. And societies that cannot distinguish between reality and illusion, as history has shown, die.
Chris Hedge is our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. This program we're recording roughly a week before we're going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let Chris Hedges and me do the yakking today. You know, the subtitle, Chris, suggests to some extent the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle, that an element of your critique is, you know, the decline of print culture, the rise of screen culture. And you do talk about the technical decline of literacy in the book. How much of is that a part of your argument, that the technologies of communication are a central force in this, or is that exaggerating their importance?
No, it's huge. We have shifted, or in the process of shifting, from a print-based society to an image-based society. Now, these images are not benign. They are skillfully created to manipulate our emotions, to make us confuse how we're made to feel with knowledge, you know, in terms of the political process, to make us confuse propaganda with ideology. And when you sever yourself from a print-based culture and you allow yourself to be or allow the society to be saturated with these kinds of images, in essence, awash in lies, Curtis, whether it's the advertising or whether it's pseudo-events created by politicians or the entertainment industry, then you become hostage to the message that is being disseminated by these images. You can't dissect what is true. You see it in the healthcare debate, for instance. What is actually true, and this kind of soundbite-driven, these thought-terminating cliches that define and poison civic and political discourse. In many ways, you're reduced to sort of babbling like a child. We have huge rates of illiteracy in this country. 42 million Americans are functionally illiterate. Another 50 million Americans read at about a fourth or fifth grade level. That's almost a third of the country right there. And then you have people who are functionally literate, but they don't read anymore. I think the figure is 80% of American households didn't buy a book last year. And so I think that the shift away from a print-based culture to an image-based culture, and all totalitarian societies are image-based, is one that in the hands of the corporate state has very pernicious effects. And you look at healthcare, you know, the for-profit healthcare industry is driving the debate, saturating the airwaves with, frankly, absolutely mendacious claims about, you know, death panels and everything else, and effectively stymieing the reality, which is the fact that the for-profit healthcare industry is the problem, that any discussion of an alternative must begin with the factual understanding that it's only when we abolish the for-profit healthcare industry that we can move forward. But that's never going to happen. And the forces that have the capacity to drive public discussion forward, because, of course, they have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to access in order to do this, are ones that are creating an illusionary effect. I'm just using this as a microcosm, but it's writ large within the society at whole.
Chris Hedges, I want to just finish up on this point about technology, because what your argument you just made is one now that's roundly accepted. If you stop the technology at television, now in retrospect, even people who were defenders of the status quo 20, 30 years ago, will say, yeah, in retrospect, we can see that television is not a very healthy medium for society. It's a one-way flow. It's the choice of tyrants rather than Democrats in a society. But they'll say the Internet's interactive. It has access to this whole wealth of information. It's, for all intents and purposes, uncensored. Certainly this can't be an anti-democratic force. It's a liberating force.
Well, the Internet ghettoizes people. People retreat to, and I'm guilty of that, retreat to websites or to blogs or information that reinforces what they believe. So, you know, if you are you know, a fervent supporter of, for instance, the pro-life movement, you're probably not going to be reading Alternet and Common Dreams and, Salon.com. You're going to be retreating into websites that reinforce your belief system. The other problem with the Internet is that it's not really designed for readers. If you pull up an article, for instance, and that article is running 4,000 and 5,000 words, I think there's very few of us. I mean, I print it out. There's very few of us who can actually read it on the Internet. It has a capacity, to deliver information for people who are proactive and willing to look for that information. I mean, for instance, I'm very thankful that I can read in real time articles in the British and the French press, courtesy of the Internet. But I think that you have to be proactive, and I think most people at this point within American society are passive. They allow themselves to be fed, and of course, as you point out, that's precisely what television does. It's why I don't own a television, by the way.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of several books, including the brand-new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, that we're talking about today on the show. Again, this is a pre-recorded show. We did it roughly a week before going on air, so don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let Chris Hedges and me do the yakking. Chris, you know, one of the points you make in the book that resonates really with comments you've already made is how in our culture today in the United States, self-pity has become sort of a dominant attribute. And I thought of that when you were describing the town meetings with the people who oppose the health care reform, the notion of health care reform, and how much that seemed to be a theme, a recurring theme in the sort of anger in the audiences.
Well, I think it's important to realize that American culture, or cultures, because of course we once had distinct cultures, regional cultures, cultures of immigrants, with their own aesthetic, their own history, their own sense of self-identity, were destroyed in the early part of the 20th century and replaced with commercial or commodity culture. And this was done on purpose. There was an homogenization of American culture. And we lost something. Commercial culture or consumer culture sought quite effectively to impose within American society consumption as an inner compulsion, which is why 70% of our economy is driven on consumption. Well, in order to create this new kind of ethic or value system, we had to destroy an old value system, one based around communitarianism, around thrift, around self-sacrifice, all sorts of values that were abolished quite effectively to create, as you point out, this cult of the self. And this is really, at the core, the ethic of celebrity culture. It is about celebration of me. And of course, we use celebrity culture as a way to, latch on to celebrities as sort of idealized versions of ourselves. We all have kind of screenplays that we play out in our head. We've allowed this kind of narrative to define who we should become. And when you watch I was at professional wrestling meets and wrote about reality television. It's all about your achievement, and how you get there is irrelevant. All the kind of backstabbing, manipulation. This is like shows like Survivor would be perfect. I mean, if you look at the character traits that are celebrated in these shows, they're the character traits of psychopaths, of people who are mentally ill. It's self-aggrandizement. It's the ability to create friendships, false friendships that you then betray. It is the capacity for manipulation of others, and of course the promotion of self. And what do you get at the end of it? Well, you get money and fame, or fleeting fame. This is also the ethic of unfettered capitalism. It's the ethic of Wall Street. It's what allows the heads of huge investment firms who have taken hundreds of millions, billions of American taxpayer dollars to hand themselves out gigantic bonuses that run in the tens of hundred or hundreds of millions of dollars. And this kind of ethic has been pervasive within American society, and I think deeply self-destructive. The ethic of unfettered capitalism, of the cult of the self, really denies the capacity for anything to be sacred. Everything is commodified. Everything is judged in terms of its monetary value. Nothing has an intrinsic value. That's why, you know, we can talk about a jobless recovery, because human labor is subservient to the needs of the market. And, of course, what we're really talking about is human suffering. That's why we, the drive by corporations to commodify nature, to look at nature as something that has a potential to generate profit, is destroying the ecosystem, because we are pounding it into the ground and polluting it for money. And we fail to recognize that both human beings and the natural world have intrinsic or sacred values beyond their monetary value. So this ethic, I think, has seeped into every aspect of American society, and is, if left unchecked, really guarantees a kind of collective suicide.
Chris Hedges, in your comments just now and in your book, and the last time you were on our program a few months ago when we talked about religion, your sort of ethical critique of our society, which has a moral basis and a religious basis, comes through. And it can't help but strike me when you were describing celebrity culture and the self-absorption and the narcissism of our society, why it contradicts certain theological premises is almost self-evident, yet it seems that religion is part of the whole issue. Religion's been absorbed into this culture to a certain extent, hasn't it?
Oh, completely. Neil Gabler, who's written on this pretty wisely, argues that celebrity culture, it's not that celebrity culture and religion have been fused, so much as celebrity culture is, there's been a hostile takeover of religion by celebrity culture. And you certainly see it in among the Christian right, where figures like Joel Osteen and Pat Robertson and others are in essence celebrities. They make the money of celebrities. They travel with huge retinues of bodyguards and publicists and fly around on private Learjets. And I wrote a book on the Christian right where I spent 2 years following them around. And when these people enter the room, they enter like rock stars. I think very much that the celebrity culture has seeped into almost every aspect of our society with very pernicious and negative effects, and the whole driving engine of the Christian right is wrapped around the cult of the self. It is around Jesus or God intervening on my behalf, carrying out miracles so that I will be prosperous and have everything that I want. As a former seminarian, this message is a complete anathema to the message of Jesus Christ within the Gospels, but it is quite loyal to the message imparted by celebrity culture.
Chris Hedges, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, this is a pre-recorded show. Don't call in. Sit back and relax. Chris Hedges, the author of the new book, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, just published by Nation Books. I've had a privilege of reading it over the last month, and it is a book that you will stick with you for a long time. I can guarantee you that. Chris, we're talking about celebrity culture here, and you've been discussing it, sort of its hostile takeover of religion. One of the sections of the book I found really interesting was your discussion of sort of celebrity culture and politics and the way American electoral politics work. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's another area where our politicians have our successful politicians have become celebrities, Obama being perhaps one of the finest examples. That, what was the campaign for president about. It wasn't about issues or ideas. It was about personal narratives. It was about how we were made to feel. It was about that confusion of emotion with knowledge, the confusion of of propaganda with a core set of ideas or ideology. And I think much of the disappointment that many people, certainly liberals and progressives and others, feel towards Obama comes from having been captivated by this very hollow stagecraft. And in essence, you know, we have descended into a world, I think, that Benjamin DeMott correctly calls junk politics and junk culture, where, you know, it's no longer about ideas. It's about how, you know, how skillfully we have been manipulated by images and slogans to feel good about the celebrity politician. And the Obama campaign did that extremely well. Nobody runs for office anymore unless they can do that well.
You know, and turning to the other side, the Republicans, as I read your book, and again, I don't want to pick on Republicans here, because I think, as you just pointed out, this crosses the entire political spectrum. But the sort of disconnect between reality and sort of the belief system, and again, it comes out in these anti-healthcare reform rallies, where the points made are either factually, blatantly wrong, or just bizarre and irrelevant at best. But this doesn't seem to bother anyone, or it seems to be not of any, doesn't alter, the factual accuracy doesn't seem to be a high priority.
Isn't within the culture at large.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the way television pundits critique politicians, it's not whether what they are saying is true or untrue. And this doesn't matter whether they're Republican or Democrat. But how effectively has their artifice worked?
Mm-hmm.
Have they, you know, were they believable? Were they credible? Did they manage to convince the public? And those that cannot practice this artifice well are criticized and dismissed. Those that are able to convince a public and create an emotional bond with the public are rated successful. Truth is irrelevant. And so you're certainly right, but this is unfortunately a very small part of a much larger cultural ethic that really sweeps across political lines.
How far into the past, Chris, do you think we have to go to find politicians being elected more likely on the basis of their ideas and their talent and their vision rather than their narrative they create, their fiction about themselves?
Probably back to the 50s. Eisenhower maybe being one of the last who, Eisenhower was a fascinating figure in many ways, adopting many positions that, including warning about the military-industrial complex, and I think, you know, Eisenhower was a figure that probably would not have played out well in the television age, nor probably would have Truman. Roosevelt, of course, was a master at this and would have played out very well. But I think that with the advent of television, with the rise of the Kennedy campaign, and of course that coincided with a decline in a steady decline in sort of newsprint as a source of information, we began a seismic cultural shift, which people like Neil Postman and Daniel Borstein grasped at the time and wrote about. I think it really is with the possibility to disseminate image into every household, which television provided, that we began this kind of irrevocable decline.
Well, fortunately, we do have the great universities of the United States to sort of be the moral standard bearer, to sort of provide some countervailing force to the pressures you're talking about. Do you agree with that? That's but, a rhetorical question, I guess.
The universities, of course, have become part of the problem. They've stopped training people to ask the broad moral questions that the humanities were designed to ask, to challenge assumptions, cultural assumptions. You know, real intellectual thought is by its nature subversive because at its core it is meant to dismantle systems and examine them. And our universities, including our elite universities, and I've taught at Princeton and Columbia and NYU, are becoming, in essence, vocational schools. You know, the humanities are withering, even at places like Princeton. You know, only 100,000 university graduates last year got a degree in the humanities. You know, 1% in foreign languages, 4% in mathematics. You know, these disciplines are in irrevocable decline. And, of course, the largest major in American universities is business, which is at its core really about manipulation. And, you know, universities, especially as endowments have fallen and with state universities funds have been cut, ask academics to essentially self-generate their income. This is especially true in the sciences. So that they must reach out to corporations in order to receive funding, not only funding, but often their salary. And what's the result of this? The result is that they're essentially silenced. They are fused into the corporate state. And that's why I think universities have done such a poor job of standing up in an age of cultural decline. It's why universities have allowed this horrific system, this winnowing process, where we reward a very narrow and specific kind of intelligence, and a kind of analytic intelligence. That's what AP tests and SATs are all about. But there are many other kinds of intelligence, emotional intelligence, creative intelligence. And these kinds of things are rarely seen on campuses of elite schools. You know, you may have the odd violin player here and there, but largely these people are have, you know, a massive capacity to work and an inability to ask the kinds of questions or to challenge a corporate structure or a state structure. What you churn out are essentially systems managers, people who know only how to maintain the system, and we can see that with the response of President Obama's economic team. You know, a figure like Lawrence Summers, largely responsible for removing the firewalls that prevented the banking crisis that we're now in, destroying the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, and in 1999 passing through this bill, the Financial Services Modernization Act, that allowed commercial banks to become investment banks, and as of course turned most of our major banks into, or rendered them insolvent. Now these people have been called back to solve the problem, and all they know how to do is throw money, I mean in the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, towards the institutions they serve because they are stunted figures who are unable to think outside of the parameters of that system, to begin to create new systems, because they haven't been trained to do that, neither has Geithner or Bernanke or anyone else. And so you have a bankrupt elite, largely produced, and Summers, of course, was the president of Harvard. You have a bankrupt elite essentially trying to, well, looting the U.S. Treasury, $12 trillion in commitments, you know, printing money as fast as the Weimar Republic, to sustain a dying system. And this is tied, I think, directly to a terrible failure within our universities and our educational system. You know, anybody who stood up to critique the system itself was attacked in a kind of vicious, and is attacked in a kind of vicious right-wing campaign as being liberal. Well, this was never about being liberal. It was about those scholars and academics and critics who had moral autonomy, who stood outside the system and asked those kinds of questions. And these people whether they were economists or political scientists, or have been really either pushed to the margins or silenced.
Well, our guest today, Chris Hedges, author of Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, published just out by Nation Books. Chris, thank God, as I hear your discussion of the problems in our country and as I read your book, that we have such a great journalism and free press to safeguard the public interest. Again, I'm being facetious. Journalism, you are a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times.
Well, that doesn't mean much.
At one time. Well, it gives you certain cred. Journalism is one of the subjects you go after sharply in this book and in your other writings. Talk a little bit about the field of journalism, where it's at today, how it's changed, and, you know, your critique of it.
Well, journalism is a dying art, I'm afraid. I don't look simply to the death of newspapers and newsprint, but to the actual craft of reporting itself. One of the weaknesses of the Internet is that most people who write for the Internet do not report. They don't even pick up a telephone. You can find insightful commentary on the Internet, but not a lot of good reporting. And that skill or capacity to go out and report a story, I worry, is dying. With the death of journalism itself. Journalism has virtually been extinguished on television. Those who dominate the airwaves on television, people like Katie Couric or the late Tim Russert, are courtiers and highly paid courtiers. Couric makes $15 million a year, and I can assure you no journalist makes that kind of money, because she's a celebrity. She does, in a celebrity culture, what all celebrities do, and that's she has the capacity as an actor or a performer to make us feel good about her and the product she is selling. But news has become a kind of salacious obsession with celebrity gossip and trivia and feel-good stories that, again, are used to keep us wrapped in a state of self-delusion about what's actually happening. The decline of print, of a print-based culture, is played out quite literally in the decline of newspapers, but also, of course, we are seeing a subsequent decline in the publishing industry itself. And when we lose that capacity to report, when we lose the power of fact and the possibility of disseminating fact, then we descend into this state where the image of the primacy of the image, and I think we're already very far along. So, the news media has failed us. It is becoming more and more anemic. It's becoming more and more timid as advertisers are fleeing. Newspapers, they're terrified of offending the few sort of corporate supporters they have left. You see it, to go back to the healthcare debate, I think it's something like 60% of American doctors support single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans. I mean, statistically, our system is, I think 2 to 3 times more costly than those of state universal health systems in Britain and France and other countries, and yet even within papers like the New York Times, these kinds of voices you won't hear. You won't hear because Pfizer and other large corporations are huge advertisers and are able to propel the debate forward, and the media is very much trapped within the parameters defined by those corporations, and the great loser is the American public.
In a new book coming out by Alex Jones, which you just reviewed, you were quite critical of Jones, who, to paraphrase, made the argument that professional objective journalism was working awfully well in the United States until quite recently, and the technological reasons primarily, and some economic reasons, journalism's collapsing. But we did those, the good old days of 1960s and 70s is what really where we need to get back to. And I don't know if I'm doing fairness to Jones's argument because I haven't read his book yet. I'm basing it on your review.
No, that's fair.
And you were quite critical of that position.
Well, of course. You know, the whole notion of objectivity. And Jones, sort of a one-sentence aside, his family owns the Greenville paper. I guess it's Tennessee. I can't remember what state. in a side in the book, admits that the paper opposed the civil rights movement and desegregation. Well, you know, the objectivity, the notion of objectivity, is one that very rarely works. I suppose in a very narrow kind of reporting, where are there clearly two discernible sides, which almost never happens, possibly. But it's a disaster when you report when you're reporting on those who are being silenced or oppressed and the oppressor, because you elevate the oppressor to the same moral level as the oppressed. If you look back at and of course, objectivity, by the way, was created at the end of the 19th century by newspaper owners who previously had taken strong positions or advocated for the rights within their communities as a way of backing off and attracting advertisers across the political spectrum. And essentially what they did is wash their hands of moral responsibility. So if you look at the way, for instance, the New York Times covered lynchings, in the South, and I think between roughly 1870 and 1920, about 4,000 African Americans were burned, beaten, mutilated, hung. The Times, to give balance, would say, well, you know, it was mob violence, but these African American men prey on white women and they rape white women. Well, it turns out we know, of course, that now that this is completely untrue, that these were fabricated charges. And so the paper, in its editorials, would write about how, public lynchings are wrong, but the proclivity, this is actually an actual quote, the proclivity of Negroes to prey on white women is also a crime and a capital crime, and so the state should carry out the punishment, i.e. the state should do the lynching. That's balance. Look at the coverage of the Palestinians, where, in a recent story in the New York Times, the reporters went into a village that had been decimated by the Israelis in the bombing, in the 22-day bombing of Gaza and assault on Gaza, and quoted eyewitnesses who were there and who had suffered and who had seen it, and every other paragraph was an Israeli spokesperson who hadn't been there refuting it and making charges like, Hamas uses children as human shields and all this kind of stuff. In essence, it's just an updated version of the lynchings. The Palestinians have just become, quote unquote, the new Negroes, you see it in the healthcare debate. The parameters by which objectivity are defined are ones that often exclude, usually almost always exclude the powerless, those who don't have the kind of money to advertise. Like the pharmaceuticals and the for-profit healthcare industry, but those doctors and patients who suffer at the hands of these institutions that will quite literally make their money off of human suffering and even death. 20,000 Americans died in this country last year because they couldn't afford proper medical care. Objectivity was a creed that was created by newspaper publishers and owners to make money. It worked quite effectively to make money. It often, I think, crippled effective journalism. The great journalists in the South were not the people Alex Jones holds up at his family newspaper, but the abolitionists and those who were printing these sort of underground sheets, which, in the South during slavery could be punishable by death. Very courageous figures, but of course they couldn't make money. But they practiced real journalism. And I think that the failure of Jones's book is that he blames the decline on the internet without understanding that this has been morally, this whole false concept of objectivity has been morally crippling to journalism, and is as responsible for the decline of American journalism as a shift in technology is.
Chris Hedges, our guest, author of the new book we're talking about, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Again, this is a pre-recorded show. We did it roughly a week before going on air, so don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Chris, on journalism, some people would look to programs like Keith Olbermann's and Rachel Maddow's on the MSNBC cable channel as examples of actually there are alternatives within the system that are doing the sort of journalism you'd like. How do you respond to that?
No, they don't do journalism. I think they're part of the problem. They serve the function that the cabarets served in Berlin in the 1930s when everybody would go, all the sophisticated Berliners would go and laugh at caricatures of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. Our problem is far more serious. It's not funny. I think that shows like Colbert, and I like Colbert, and I've been on it, The Daily Show I enjoy them, but they act as a kind of safety valve. It's like signing another petition on Facebook or something. They also speak to people who share their views, and they speak in the simplified language of sound bites and cliches, which is very dangerous. I mean, when you abolish nuance within a society, create kind of rigid dogmatic lines on both sides that can't be crossed. I think that there, the loss of good reporting, the kind of stuff Cy Hirsch does, is a tremendous blow, because when you don't have those factual investigations, and look at the great I.F. Stone or others, when you don't have that ability to dissect a system and then disseminate it in a sophisticated manner, which can only, frankly, be done through print, then you're left with, a kind of chattering class on the left and the right that I think is finally, in the end, largely ineffectual in mobilizing or changing public opinion. It can solidify or play to opinions that people already hold. But I don't think that they're effective engines of change.
Chris, you talk in almost apocalyptic terms. Your critique is very powerful in the book. And just to make it more tangible in people's minds, when you're talking about this country, going over the cliff, or just, the totalitarianism and propaganda, and at one point you call this a society in precipitous decline, this sort of future, I have a daughter who's 21. Many of my students are obviously that age. I mean, the sort of future they're looking at then, is it just pretty much the same world 20 years from now, people shopping in malls and sort of looking at mindless ads and doing the sort of stuff they're doing today? Or does precipitous decline mean something qualitatively worse than what we're even presently experiencing?
Well, qualitatively worse.
And what would that look like?
Well, we're already seeing it through climate change. I mean, they use the word drought to describe what's happening in the Southwest. This isn't a drought. The water's not coming back. The methane chimneys are, which, and methane is a gas that is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide in terms of influencing the climate, greenhouse gas emissions, are barreling up from thawing permafrost. We literally are watching the system that sustained human life be destroyed, and we're amusing ourselves, to quote Neil Postman, to death while we do it. We are entering an age of neo-feudalism. That term jobless recovery is key. It's a recovery for Wall Street, but the working class in this country isn't going to recover. And let's be clear, employment is probably, unemployment is probably running about 20%. When you know, Reagan disappeared 2 million people off the unemployment rolls by suddenly counting 1.5 million members of the armed forces as employed. Clinton disappeared 5 million by deciding that those who had either had low-wage jobs, and most people at Walmart work for about 28 hours a week, although in real terms their income places them below the poverty level, they still get food stamps, or people who've stopped looking for jobs, 5 million people were disappeared by Clinton. When you combine those who have jobs that do not provide adequate income or have given up looking for work, our unemployment rate is staggering. And these jobs are not coming back. We are still shedding jobs at a faster rate per month than in the months after the 1929 crash. So we are reconfiguring our society. We have allowed a rapacious oligarchy, which controls, I mean, the top 1% controls more wealth than the bottom 90% combined, to hijack our society on behalf of corporations, which have no national loyalty. These are supranational organizations. When they talk about being competitive with workers now, they talk about being competitive with prison labor in China. It's why all the factories that, through NAFTA, migrated over the border to Mexico are now being dismantled and moved to China. So instead of paying workers 90 cents or a dollar an hour, they'll go to China and pay them 10 cents an hour. And what the message that these corporations are essentially delivering to the American working class is that they have to be competitive with prison labor in China. You know, the squandering of American resources to sustain the financial oligarchy and these investment houses has a tremendous cost, and the cost is that there will not be the resources to assist in any way this growing class of disenfranchised, dispossessed. So I think we're talking about a completely new structure and configuration, one that in order for the oligarchy to maintain is going to require a rise of a kind of security and surveillance state that could be very frightening.
Chris Hedges, do you think that the free market, free enterprise, profit-driven economic system is reformable to make it serve human ends, or do we have to go to some sort of socialist, post-capitalist system?
Well, I'm a socialist, but, you know, I should qualify that by saying that we're all socialists now. Socialism is just the use of large government resources or infusion of huge government resources into the public system. We're doing that. Unfortunately, it's corporate socialism. I just happen to be a socialist who believes that those resources should have gone to the poor, the working, and the middle class. We had a system of managed capitalism that worked fairly well. I mean, unregulated capitalism has built within it, Marx was wrong on many things, but he was right on that, on the seeds of self-destruction. It will just consume itself, which is what's happening. The lifting of regulatory reforms, these weren't just designed to create a responsible financial structure, but in many ways they were the bulwarks for democracy itself. And once these reforms were abolished, which corporations, through lobbying 35,000 lobbyists in Washington and hijacking our electoral system where nobody can achieve office unless they have huge sums of corporate money, have destroyed not just the economy but the democratic state itself. I don't know how it's going to come back. I think that, in almost every issue, whether it's, military spending, I mean, half of all discretionary spending still goes to the defense industry. We are borrowing at a staggering rate in order to sustain an empire that we can no longer afford. Either we disengage responsibly, build a new ethic, not only in terms of how we conduct our lives, but our relationship to the natural environment, one which walks away from the commodity culture and the consumer culture that requires a new kind of humility, a new kind of simplicity. I don't think all of these things necessarily mean a diminishing in the quality of lifestyle. In fact, I think it probably means an enhancing of it. But we're not doing that. We're still being pushed to consume, to borrow, and to maintain a structure that, if it's not radically reconfigured, will kill us. I mean, certainly kill us as a democratic state.
Chris Hedges, traditionally, the political forces that lead towards the reformation of the profit system to better serve the working and middle classes, or its replacement in substantial areas, is the political left. And you write about this a little bit in your book. It seems to be missing in action in American society.
It's bankrupt. It pays lip service to values it refuses to fight for. I mean, the best illustration of this is the Clinton administration. You know, the left in this country purports to care about the plight or concerns of the working class, and yet it supported a Democratic Party that pushed through NAFTA, the great betrayal of the working class, as well as so-called welfare reform. And all of these people who are about to go off unemployment insurance are going to get a taste of Clinton's welfare reform when they try and live on $143 a month. The Democratic Party, under Clinton's direction, realized that if it abandoned labor and the working class, they would have nowhere else to go. If it took corporate money and did corporate bidding, which it did, they could have fundraising parity with the Republicans. Well, now not only do they have parity, they actually have more. But it is those of us who are not part of the oligarchic elite who have paid for it. And unfortunately, the power of image, the power of pseudo-events, the power of our of a society to manipulate how we are made to feel has incapacitated the liberal class along with everyone else and rendered it bankrupt. I think much of the anger on the part of the working class towards liberals, which if you look closely really began in earnest after NAFTA was passed in 1994, is not misplaced because the hypocrisy is staggering. Especially every 4 years in presidential campaigns, go out and talk about these issues and then go back to Washington and serve the corporate state, which is what Obama has done, both in terms of our imperial wars, in terms of the military-industrial complex, in terms of the healthcare industry, in terms of the bailout, and on and on and on. So I think that the bankruptcy of liberalism, and this is really, you know, the core of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, about that when a society has a bankrupt liberalism, a class that no longer is willing to fight for an egalitarian society, then you descend into the void of moral nihilism. And I think that and Dostoevsky knew exactly what that produced, which was Lenin and the Bolsheviks. And I think that we have also embraced a very frightening moral nihilism for many of the same reasons.
Well, on that note, Chris Hedges, I'm afraid our time is drawing to a close, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good luck with your work. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering today's show, and I want to thank Melissa Trentz, as always, for being my producer. I'm Bob McChesney. Please join me back here in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today we'll see partly sunny skies with a high of 68 degrees, tonight mostly clear with a chilly low of 46, Monday sunny skies with a high of 72, Monday night, mostly clear with a low of 44. Tuesday sunny with a high of 75. Tuesday night mostly clear with a low around 50. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
From PR.